Hello, this is Science Weekly for Monday the 20th of October 2008. I'm Alok Char. Coming up, we discuss what our guest calls the 21st century fear, and in a podcast first for us, we attempt to recreate his experiment. Plus... we welcome a real-life Time Lord to the show to discuss, amongst other things, the future of time.
In the French Revolution in the 18th century, they tried decimal time, which is 10 hours, 100 minutes, 100 seconds. You can still find pocket watches and occasionally clocks with this decimal system. Usually you'll find it with the decimal and the base 60 system, because they kind of had an inkling that it might not last.
And why it's now scientifically justifiable to call Northerners dirty. That's what it says here. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Welcome to the pod, everyone. With me here is science correspondent Ian Sample and from the arts half of the soon-to-be-demolished Guardian building, Nell Bowes. Welcome to you both.
Hello.
Hello.
Right, well, in a break with tradition, we're not going to introduce our special guest at this stage in case we prejudice our incredibly scientific experiment. So let's get straight to it. Let's whisk you away, relax, and let your mind wander. Please close your eyes, except for health and safety reasons if you're driving or operating heavy machinery. You're excused in that case.
Here we are in a central line tube train. You can see there's about 15 or 20 other people in this train, and they seem to be going about their own business. There's someone over there reading The Guardian. And some people staring into space, and one or two are looking around. But it's just a sort of everyday tube ride. There's two people standing up there by the door, a man in a grey suit there, and opposite him is a woman, and she's carrying the handbag there, and she's just looking down at that. And across the way are three people just sitting on the seats there, someone looking down, staring at their hands, and another one reading a book there, and someone's just staring ahead, perhaps reading the advert.
Is King's Cross St Pancras. Change the Northern, Piccadilly and Victoria lines. National and international rail services. Exit for the Royal National Institute of Blind People.
Okay, experiment over. How weird would it have been if you were actually on a tube listening to this at the same time? Here to explain what we've just heard is Daniel Freeman. He is a Wellcome Trust Fellow at the Institute of Psychiatry at King's College London, as well as a clinical psychologist. He's just written a book called Paranoia, the 21st Century Fear. Daniel, welcome. Can you just explain to us why we were listening to you describing people on a tube train?
Well, this is the first means of assessing paranoia in the laboratory. There's a real sort of spectra that haunts the study of paranoia, and that's justified suspicions. We're interested in fears that are unrealistic, but sometimes it's very hard to know. So if you look at someone's face, you don't know whether they're being hostile or whether they're not even thinking about you. So what we're doing here is presenting people with a virtual reality social environment.
And this was a study published earlier this year. What did you find?
Well, what we found is that in this neutral social environment, because we knew it's neutral because the characters are programmed not to be hostile, we found that nonetheless a significant proportion, about one in four people, had paranoid thoughts about the characters. So for example, they thought that some people were staring at them in order to upset them, or trying to isolate them, or trying to intimidate them.
Which is strange, given that these are all computer-generated characters. But let's step back a bit. So your new book is called Paranoia. What in the psychiatric and psychological sense is the definition of paranoia? We might all feel we've had paranoid thoughts, might know that someone's out to get us, well, some more than others. But what is paranoia?
Well, as you say, paranoia is a term that's used quite widely. When I use the term paranoia, what we're talking about is unfounded or exaggerated fears that others are deliberately trying to harm us. So we might think, for example, that someone's trying to irritate us or to distress us or is spreading malicious gossip, or perhaps that we're under physical threat. In paranoia, there's a whole range of social, psychological, and physical threats that can be incorporated into it.
So there's a whole range of things there. For example, walking down a street late at night and worried that you're going to get mugged, for example, or not letting your kids play out in the streets because you feel that they're going to get murdered or something like that.
That's right, yeah. I mean, who we think the perpetrators are varies widely. Sometimes we think it's family or friends or strangers or work colleagues or even the government.
Your book, The Paranoia, has some interesting examples from fiction as well. I mean, despite the fact that these definitions of paranoia are probably quite recent in psychiatry, Shakespeare seemed to have a handle on this a long time ago.
That's right. So Shakespeare has come up with some wonderful examples. But also another person from the 18th century, very interesting, Francis Bacon, who's often credited as the founder of the scientific method, he wrote about it too, and he described paranoia. He said, "Suspicions amongst thoughts are like bats amongst birds. They ever fly by twilight. They lose friends, they cloud the mind, and they check with business."
In a modern sense, then, you're suggesting that paranoia is increasing. There's more of it around, that people are increasingly worried about the world around them. First of all, is it justified? And how'd you come to that conclusion? And is it justified? Is the world getting scarier? I mean, it seems to be getting scarier.
Well, we don't have the data to know for sure, okay? But I think there are grounds for thinking we might be entering an age of paranoia. There are perhaps three main reasons for this. One reason is that I think there's over-reporting of dangers, of threats from other people. So, for example, cancer kills about 500 times more people a year than murder. But if you look in your newspapers, you're twice as likely to read about murder than cancer, for example. And this over-reporting fosters paranoia. You really just have to think about the effect of this, for example, about imagining watching the movie Jaws and then swimming in the sea. Repeated images and very emotional ones skew estimates of the likelihood that the bad thing's going to happen. I certainly think that's happening about fears about other people. There are also a number of social changes taking place that are likely to raise levels of paranoia. So, for example, this year was the first time ever that more people live in urban areas than rural. Back in 1800, 5% of people lived in urban areas. It's projected that by 2030, 65% of people will live in urban areas. And there's lots of evidence suggesting that people who live in urban areas have higher levels of paranoia. So on the back of this social change, it's likely to be an increase of paranoia.
Why would people living in cities have more paranoia?
Well, that's a really interesting question. There's probably a number of things that are contributing to that. Isolation is one of them, and then maybe more drug taking, and they're more stressful, anxiety-inducing environments. But we don't know exactly why urbanicity is associated with more paranoia.
No, you've got a question.
I was just wondering, when you're talking about dealing with paranoia, you talk about raising awareness of it. And I was wondering how talking about fear and paranoia is likely to make people feel happier or more relaxed. It doesn't quite make sense to me.
Well, I think it's striking that paranoia is perhaps almost as common as anxiety and depression, and yet it's far less talked about. And there's certainly research evidence that people who don't feel able to talk about their feelings have higher levels of paranoia. So I think it's often helpful to know that you're not alone, that you're not, for example, going mad, and that this is actually a common experience, and if it is troubling, there are ways of getting over it.
At what point does someone's anxiety tip over into something that a psychiatrist would be interested in terms of a psychosis or being a neurotic? I mean, for example, I might walk into a room and think, I don't know anyone here, I'm a bit shy, and I'm just going to keep myself to myself because perhaps everyone doesn't want to talk to me. Is that paranoid? I mean, that sounds like it's paranoid, but does it fit with your description?
That's a bit more like social anxiety. And the difference between social anxiety and paranoia is that in paranoia you have the idea that there's intent to cause you some harm. So when you're socially anxious, you might think that you might look an idiot or foolish or a poor conversationalist. In paranoia, you think others are trying to make you look like an idiot.
So one thing I want to know, you wrote this book with your brother.
Yes.
Do you ever have any slightly paranoid thoughts about each other getting, I mean, you're on the podcast, where's he?
That's a very good question. He was invited along to come And we were advised that you really wanted only one of us.
It might have been difficult with the voices, that's all.
And as much as I'm enjoying it, I'd have loved to have him replace me.
Ian, you've been quiet all of this time. What's going on in your mind?
No, just to be devil's advocate in a way, really, and just to... What is your evidence that paranoia is actually going up? Because I know in this study you're talking about one in four in the general public having regular paranoid thoughts, but presumably there wasn't very great data before that. And I wonder if maybe as urbanisation increases, the number of people experiencing some kind of paranoid thoughts increases, but do actual levels of paranoia increase among individuals, if you see my point? I mean, I just would like to know sort of, I'm not convinced that it's going on, because I don't sort of interact and see people around me sort of becoming really afraid of the world we're living in. I wonder if it's a myth.
Well, I just recall an incident that happened to me not so long ago, just in the queue for a post office, and there were two women in front of me, and one of them said to the other one, look, those clocks don't agree, which I thought was a bit a dull thing. And then the other person says, yes, they're trying to confuse us. The other person then said, yes, it's typical of the government. They tell you lies. And then you find out 50 years later that they lied. And the person says, yeah, that's right. And now they're trying to make us eat genetically modified food, so we don't live for those 50 years.
Oh, it sounds like a Monty Python sketch.
it was great. But one of the important things is that paranoia has traditionally been seen as simply a sign of severe mental illnesses such as schizophrenia. And therefore, the idea that it was on a spectrum is neglected, and it was also thought of something that was ununderstandable, that wasn't possible to understand in normal psychological terms. There's been a huge shift in the last 10 years to understand it psychologically, and from the work that we're now doing, the way we're understanding it, we can make these judgments that perhaps it's on the increase, given what we know about some of the causes of paranoia.
In Daniel's book, there is actually a questionnaire to try and work out how paranoid you are. And our very own Ian and Nell and producer Andy have been doing this questionnaire. So we're going to go through those results a bit later. Guys, just make sure you finish your stuff there. One more question before we wind up this section, though, Daniel. Are there any cultural differences in the way we perceive paranoia? So someone in the UK, for example, and someone in Japan, are they paranoid about the same things?
It's a very good question. I mean, there hasn't been much research on paranoia. People have been much more interested in diagnoses such as schizophrenia. But there is some evidence suggesting some differences in the content in paranoia. So, for example, in Japan, there are greater fears about being slandered and being shamed. And that kind of fits in from some of the important dynamics in Japanese society.
All right. Well, Daniel, thank you very much for all of that. Paranoia, the 21st Century Fear, is a nice little red book, and it's going to be published this Thursday by Oxford University Press.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk with Alok Jha.
With a quick look at some of this week's science stories, here's Nell and Ian with the News Jam.
News Jam.
A brain implant has allowed paralysed monkeys to move their limbs. Scientists have tapped into their thoughts and redirected signals to the animal's muscles. It's being seen as a major development in the search for treatments for people who have lost the use of their limbs because of spinal cord injuries or strokes. The work is the first to show that signals from brain cells can be rerouted around damaged areas of the central nervous system.
The government has committed the UK to cutting greenhouse gas emissions by 80% despite the challenging economic conditions. Ed Miliband, who's the new Energy and Climate Change Secretary, says it will be done by the middle of the century. Environmental campaigners are widely welcoming the improvement on the current 60% target. He's also pledged to amend the energy bill to create feed-in tariffs, allowing small-scale energy producers, such as homes with wind turbines or solar panels, to sell electricity at a guaranteed price.
Red squirrels have been discovered that have immunity to a lethal pox virus that has wiped out large numbers of the animals in England and Wales. The native species has seen dramatic declines across the country since the introduction of North American grey squirrels in the 19th century. And the Zoological Society of London has asked people to send in dead red squirrels for autopsy. Tests suggested several of them had contracted the pox, but had developed a resistance to it. Now researchers think it's feasible to protect the species with a vaccine.
And finally, men of the North, hang your heads in shame. Spot checks on commuters have revealed the further north men live, the dirtier their hands. In Newcastle, swabs of men's hands revealed more than half were contaminated with bacteria, normally found in faeces. The percentage of the unclean fell with latitude, with 34% of Liverpudlian men testing positive for faecal bacteria, 21% in Birmingham, 15% in Cardiff and 6% in London. Researchers at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine approached 409 commuters waiting at bus stops outside major train stations in the five cities. They found the trend with men, but not women.
Now, Ian, thank you very much. Before we go any further, I want to ask you where you're all from. How dirty are your hands? Ian?
Oxfordshire.
Is that Midlands? Where is that?
Midlands. South. Goodness sake. South. You northerner.
South. What about you, Nell?
London, but then I'm a woman, so, you know, I'm worst of the pack.
We have something to say about the women in this study, surely, Ian, in a second. Daniel, where are you?
I'm pleased to say at this point that I'm from London.
You are from London, so I've got the dirtiest hands here. Hooray, hooray. I'm glad that Ben's hand-washing cream thing is available for us all to use here. We'll get onto that in just a sec there. But, Ian, the serious story here, the paralysed monkeys who could move their limbs with this implant. I mean, we've heard stuff like this before. What's this latest iteration?
The kind of stuff that's been done on this before is where you essentially place electrodes into a monkey's brain. It's always been monkeys or apes. And you read out signals from the motor neurons in the motor cortex, those neurons which fire the movements of your muscles on your limbs. But in the past, they've only used this to control a cursor on a screen or to move a robotic arm. And you know, that work is pretty impressive and it's ongoing. Now, this study did something different in reading out the messages from the motor cortex in the brain, running it through a computer, cleaning up the signal, amplifying it, and then running it directly to the muscles. And these monkeys had an injection which temporarily paralyzed their arms. So they'd be playing a game, they were taught to play a game, and then they were given the injection to paralyze their arms. And then using the implant, they were then able to regain movement of their wrists. This is only a couple of muscles we're talking about moving, so it's very preliminary. I hope I don't have to add. But it proves the principle. And they were tapping into single neurons to fire a couple of muscles. And that's the really interesting aspect of this, getting proper functional movement.
And so what's the potential for humans? I mean, obviously, you say it's very early stage, but, you know, is this something that you think could potentially be used for people with spinal injuries or injuries where their nerves have been damaged?
Yeah, absolutely. This is for patients with spinal cord damage, even to the point of paraplegia. But the caution being, you know, long term to come, because one of the key hurdles they've got to get over is when you start dropping electrodes into the brain, over time they get encapsulated in scar tissue, and that degrades the signal you can read from the neurons. So you're not going to go in and give someone major invasive surgery every few months just to move these electrodes around. Now, what this study showed is you can actually you can find a bunch of neurons in another part of the motor cortex that are nothing to do with the action you're trying to replicate. And actually, a monkey will learn to use those. Just randomly, by trial and error, they'll learn to use some motor neurons that might be just for blinking or something like that. They'll co-opt them and use them in a different way. So there is room, scope for finding a way around this, but it's still an issue. But, you know, this is where they're working towards.
So if you're looking to get movements that are much more complex, maybe using several muscles at once, what sort of timescale are you putting on it?
Well, what's really nice about this is there's something else you can do. Instead of running wires to every individual muscle, I mean, to close your hand might take about 13 muscles, okay? What you can do, and what these guys are talking about doing, is you take the signal out of the brain and you actually feed it back into the spine, where you can do a very simple stimulation of a bunch of nerves, and they themselves will do a coordinated movement.
So there's a kind of a grasp action that
you
can...
Yeah, exactly. So you bypass the injured part, go into the spine, lower down, and then just stimulate the nerves there. But the researchers themselves said, look, we're talking 10, 20 years. That's which could mean, you know, that's up there with sort of fusion. That's sort of 40, it could mean 50 years.
I think it's closer than fusion.
But the others, you know, the other scientists I spoke to were saying, look, we expect to be doing experimental stuff within 5 years.
So, on humans?
Yeah, on humans. Yeah. I mean, this, you know, experimental stuff, very simple, but it's a start.
All right, very exciting stuff. One story we didn't mention in the news jam, but which we'll talk about now, is that on Wednesday, coming Wednesday, there's going to be a rereading of the abortion bill, or the abortion part of the human fertilisation and embryology bill, which is going through Parliament at the moment. What are the issues that are going to be voted on this week, Ian?
Well, it's a very big deal for the UK, and there's a number of amendments that have been tabled from the pro side and the anti side, if you like. I mean, the so-called sort of pro pro-choicers want to see women only having to seek one signature from a doctor before they have an abortion. At the moment, you have to seek two. They want to see nurses being allowed to do abortions, if they have the skills. And often this may mean, very minor sort of surgical procedures. Most importantly, they want to see the Abortion Act extended to Northern Ireland, where obviously abortion is still almost always illegal, and that will be the biggest issue coming out of Wednesday. I mean, there are a few other sort of tweaks here and there that are going on, but
the reason it's come up again, I suppose, I mean, the reason we were talking about it before was in the context of stem cell research, and the human fertilization embryology bill was a crucial part of allowing various types of stem cell research, and the abortion sort of story came up then. Back then, the people trying to change the abortion time limits were suggesting that there was survivability beyond even at 20 weeks, for example, at 20 weeks, which there's no evidence for. It's interesting that they've changed their tune now. That's not their story anymore. They've got a different thing that they're going for.
Yeah, I mean, you know, at the time when all of this came up for debate initially, there were some people tabling, 12, 13-week limits on abortion. And and David Cameron, obviously, Tory leader, voted for 20 weeks alongside a lot of other conservatives. That vote was lost. I mean, it went to 24 weeks. People voted to keep the status quo as 24 weeks. So that is not going to be... There is an amendment down to reduce it to 20, but it was put down in error and it won't be selected for discussion on Wednesday.
Well, we'll keep you updated with all that stuff. Now, we mentioned this before, Hans. Ian, the end of that story about the dirty hands from the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, a reputable institution, so I'm believing this research. You didn't say anything about women.
Well, I didn't want to sort of tar them with the same brush as men, but you don't get a trend with women. I mean, if you look across the overall contamination they found of all the women they looked at, and this is again for these sort of five or six different bacteria that you will pretty much only find coming out of one area, their average contamination was 27%, but it only varied between 21% in London and 31% in Liverpool, and so the numbers were all around 20-30. Still shows, though, that in London the women's hands were more than three times dirtier than the men here, which means we've maybe all just gone very metrosexual, and don't know what's going on with men in London.
I just ask, I know you said sort of reputable origin, but 400 people, really?
Absolutely, take your point.
Out of all these, across all these cities and across men and women.
Well, you don't have
five in each.
You don't have to have lots of as long as the study's well designed. I'm assuming it was.
I laughed when I first saw this study, and I asked them, the first thing I asked them was, are any of these results statistically significant? And they are. And I obviously asked her the question, what is going on here? Why is this happening? And she just says, well, the only thing she can think of is that men up north are too hard to wash their hands.
Which is a lie. Daniel, what do you make of this?
Well, as a psychologist, I says I wonder whether there's also going to be a north-south difference in levels of obsessive compulsive disorder.
Oh, okay,
but
good.
But I can't figure out whether it indicates that in the north, because there's more contamination, there's less OCD because people seem to be less worried about contamination, or whether in the other people in the north are going to be more worried because there is contamination. So I'm not sure which way it would work.
The trend might reverse in the next 10 years, is it?
Basically, I think we've decided that you've got the dirtiest hands here.
Shall I pick up the antibacterial hand wash?
I think that the antibacterial hand wash is yours.
Do you know what? After I read that story, I did actually wash my hands.
So right. Did I. I hadn't even gone to the loo.
That's how reasoning passes work.
You can find more about all of this stuff at guardian.co.uk/science, although you might not want to, probably. Noel, can you squirt some stuff onto your hands? Please. Ooh, that's a really unpleasant sound.
It doesn't look like
minty. It feels really cold and weird and sticky.
That's called washing your hands.
Science Weekly.
Let's have a look at what you've been saying about our recent podcasts. This is from Carlos.
Hi, Alok and the rest of the crew. Nice programme on maths. There's one question I want to ask. Why are you all giggling?
You sounded like Flashheart out of Blackadder. Hi, Queenie. Nice programme on maths.
There's one question I want to ask. Why is it that for about the last 100 years, so much research in pure mathematics has focused on topology? For those of you who don't know what that is, it's the branch of mathematics that studies the properties of a space that are preserved under continuous deformations, as if that makes it any clearer. Carlos goes on, if you look at the Fields medalists in the last several decades, many of them have been awarded to topologists. Why is topology the preeminent field that it is?
Topology is something about maps and surfaces, as far as I can get. I have no idea. Maybe it's all that's left to discover. We should email Marcus about this. James Talk posted this on our Facebook wall.
I recently discovered these podcasts and I love them. The recent episode with Sir John Pendry is one of the most interesting yet, along with Music and the Brain. Fantastic.
Daniel, by the way, we don't always read out comments about how wonderful we are. Usually it's just how rubbish we are and how I think we've got everything wrong.
I wondered why you'd ask me to send that one in, actually, but there we go.
By the way, a little later than we promised you last week, we have that extended interview with MIT's hurricane expert, Kerry Emanuel. That's now online. You can find it on the science pages. Following that, PMAGN left a comment pointing everyone to a discussion on the links between the number of named storms in the Atlantic Basin and Northern Hemisphere sea surface temperature anomalies. Have a look at that if you're interested. You can have your say on today's show either by joining our Facebook group and posting a comment or leaving something on the blog now at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. Next, what's arguably the most fundamental measurement in science? Shh. There it was, the second. We take time for granted, but not at the Royal Observatory in Greenwich. They love it there. David Rooney is the curator of timekeeping at the place where GMT was born. Ironically, though, we were late for the interview. My damn atomic clock's been on the blink for weeks now. I need some more cesium, I think.
We're surrounded by timekeepers. You know, the microwave oven's got them. The central heating's got a clock somewhere in it. But all of these things are only any good if you know what to set them to. And that's been... that's been a pressing concern for 200 years. People want to know the time at another place. So, you know, it's easy enough to find the time from a sundial if you've got a sundial on the side of the church, or if the church clock tells you that it's midday. But as the Industrial Revolution went on, people wanted to know more accurately the time, more precisely. And then when you start developing things like railway systems, you want to know the time somewhere else, but you want to standardize time, because if you're running a railway from, I don't know, London to Bristol, then whose time do you put on the timetables? The local time in all of the towns that you might stop at is going to be different according to the sun. So do you have to change your watch 20 times in a journey? So what the railway people wanted to do was to say, well, look, never mind what the sun says anymore. We can cut ourselves off from that. And we'll choose one time, the time on one meridian, of which there's an infinite number to choose from, and we'll say that's the time that we'll go by, and that's the time we'll put onto our timetables. This was a 19th century concern, and the time chosen was Greenwich time, simply because the astronomers at the Royal Observatory kept the time best.
We heard the BBC pips. Where did they come from? They've become a sort of national timekeeping sort of sound now.
Yeah, the six pips on the BBC, very much part of our timekeeping culture. They've been going on since 1924, and they were a joint venture between the Royal Observatory and the BBC. The BBC was just 2 years old by then. It was still the British Broadcasting Company, founded as a consortium of radio manufacturers. And right from the start, the BBC realised that they could broadcast time to a much greater population instantaneously, because, you know, if you're listening, if you've got the kits to listen to Children's Hour or the Light Service, you could hear the time. And so they broadcast the time originally, and quite bizarrely, by playing tubular bells tuned to the Westminster chimes at the top of the hour. And they got their time signal by opening the windows of their studio, which was on the banks of the Thames, and listening for Big Ben. And they'd play along with the tubular bells and broadcast it across the nation. I mean, it sounds pretty gimcrack. In fact, it was, because if you look at the speed of sound, it means it goes out about 2 seconds too late. So it's like the pips on digital radio now.
The way we measure time, the way we keep time now, is kind of a little bit quaint in a way, isn't it? It's the fact that it's all based around GMT. In the internet in the days, are there other ways that people are keeping time in a standard way? Things like universal time, or what's all that about?
Yeah, it's got complicated, and it got complicated around about the 1950s when the physicists invented the atomic clock, which for the first time meant that there was a clock more accurate than the Earth. The spinning Earth was our timekeeper from the start of us measuring time until the atomic clock was devised in the National Physical Laboratory and elsewhere in the 1950s. It looks at the fundamental properties of matter to extract time information, which you can then use to drive a clock, rather than looking at the rotation of the Earth and the the apparent movement of the stars. So that started to change things, and it meant that GMT, which is an Earth rotation timescale, started to be useless for other technologies where you want something more accurate, more precise. So the atomic clocks are fine. You know, the length of every second is identical. That's the nature of them. But the problem is that if you set a timescale based entirely on atomic time, it doesn't always match the time according to the sun. And that's what we're hardwired to as humans. So, you know, the sun being overhead at noon and the passage of daylight and darkness and the seasons. So what people decided was that we need some kind of compromise. We want a timescale that's based on these really accurate atomic seconds, but we want it to be tied to GMT, essentially, to the rotation of the Earth. So that's why we now have leap seconds occasionally, sometimes on New Year's Eve at midnight. You might hear seven pips on the BBC because they've inserted another second into time. Essentially, all they've done is relabel time to bring it back into step with GMT. So what we have, in fact, is UTC, Coordinated Universal Time, never more than 9/10 of a second away from Greenwich Mean Time, but that's what we have. And bizarrely, the way that it's kept, it's no longer one clock. It's no longer one timekeeper. It's 260 atomic clocks around the world. It's 50 timing centres. Ours is the NPL in Teddington. And they send their timekeeping information to a laboratory in France every month by email. And it's averaged out by the office in Sèvres, just outside of Paris, which averages time for the world and sends, bizarrely, an email back to all of these time centres saying, last month your time was so many nanoseconds wrong, so steer your clocks a little bit. So in fact, UTC is only ever available a month in arrears, and yet it's accurate to a tiny fraction of a second.
David, thanks very much. Just got one more question for you. What watch are you wearing?
It's one of my many watches in various stages of repair. It's just a nice little wind-up Swiss automatic watch.
We need to know what the curator of timekeeping believes, that's all. All right, yeah. David, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And you can hear much more of that interview, including how they decided GMT would become the standard, why a woman in Edwardian London was the victim of a dirty tricks campaign because she tried to make a living out of literally selling time, and the decimalisation of minutes and seconds. It's all in this week's Science Weekly Extra podcast. That's at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. David Rooney's book, Ruth Belville, The Greenwich Time Lady, is published by the National Maritime Museum.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk.
Back to the studio now and our guest, Daniel Freeman. Daniel, you hinted just earlier about this idea that paranoia is on the increase. How do we start to measure these sorts of things?
The virtual reality method is perhaps the only way of getting really at the heart of assessing thoughts that are genuinely and we're sure are unfounded. But of course, it's not practical to use it at the moment in clinics or in wider epidemiological studies. So there are generally two ways of assessing paranoia. Firstly, through an interview method with the person, where the interviewer has to make a judgment about the sorts of evidence the person is citing and perhaps information from other informants. Or secondly, from self-report questionnaires, like the ones that have been filled in today.
So in the book, there is a questionnaire. There are 16 questions where you can rate whether you're, for example, the first question is certain individuals have had it informing. You can rate one, not at all, or totally, and five. Add these things up, and you can get a spectrum of how paranoid someone is. And that, take us through that. What are the numbers involved? And at what point do you get interested as a psychiatrist?
Well, this questionnaire has been used with hundreds of people in the general population, but also in clinical groups, people with persecutory delusions. There are 16 items. Rated on a scale from 1 to 5, so you can score between 16 and 80. And as you said, so there's certain items, for example, I was convinced there was a conspiracy against me, or I was sure someone wanted to hurt me. What we find is that about 40% of people will score 16 on this scale, which means they're reporting no paranoid thoughts at all. And about 45% will score between 17 and 31. So quite a number of people will be endorsing them. And about 15% will score above 31. And in clinical practice, typically people score between 40 and 70 on this scale.
And so at that level, the paranoia is becoming a psychiatric problem.
That's very likely, but with any problem, whether it's anxiety or depression or paranoia, it really becomes a problem when the person becomes distressed by it and it's interfering with their day-to-day lives. And that sometimes doesn't matter how much depression or anxiety there, but it's also how you react to these experiences.
Well, producer Andy and Ian and Nell have all done this questionnaire, and why don't you share your numbers with us, Ian? What did you get? Bear in mind that what was the psychiatric level you were worried about?
I think it's about 40.
40. What was yours above 40?
No, I think the one thing I thought about this study is, I think, to be fair, most people are going to come out with a 16 on this because
they know what they're going.
Because the questions really are very. There's no nuance of social anxiety in there, or kind of.
What were your results before you?
This questionnaire is a deliberately very clear persecutory thoughts. Yeah. It's not about social anxiety. There's definitely an intention to harm in it. But despite that, it's 40% of people will score zero on this. 16.
Yes.
So I recognise, and probably 16, but I was iffy 17, because there's one of the questions in here which was people have been hostile towards me on purpose. I mean, there's things I've done to piss people off and they've been hostile in return. Well, just like driving and things like that. I mean, I've done things where I've encouraged people to be hostile towards me, so no point pretending that hasn't happened.
I think the other thing is that this is actually in the past month, so I would agree with,
Ian.
Sorry, who? I mean, I'm sure certain people did things in order to annoy me. I have thought my brother has done things solely in order to annoy me. And I suspect I might be right. But that's been, that was about 20 or 30 years ago.
All right, let's not go that far.
In the past month, I'm a 16.
There's also a difficulty, though, of actually recalling right in the moment whether you've had those thoughts. I don't know whether in the past month you have actually veered away from a particular street or a group of people, and you might have done that erroneously, possibly.
Well, it's true when you talk about driving, or you talk about kind of getting your bike nicked and things like that. It's quite hard in a studio to bring those specific episodes to mind.
Yeah, and I'm certainly hesitate to ask you about your thoughts about your work colleagues or anything.
Producer Andy, quickly.
I think I filled mine in wrong. I got 36.
What?
I don't consider myself very paranoid, I must say, but I think I got in my head like one individual.
Hang on, I think we're going to have to wheel in a couch for you.
So, your producer's been very open and honest, and exactly. Still only in the top 15% on that question.
That's producer Andy, I'm going to have to talk to you afterwards. Are you all right, mate?
Can I book in with you, actually, Daniel? We'll sort it afterwards.
Daniel, what do you do with this information? I mean, we're having a bit of a laugh about this, but seriously, what do you as a psychiatrist do with information like this?
This question, I would use someone I'm seeing in treatment to see how they progress and whether there's improvements, depending on what we're doing in therapy. That would be the main use, rather than to use it to diagnose, for example, decide there's a definite clinical problem. By the time someone's seeing me, they're having some suspicious thoughts and they're worried about them, and this is an outcome measure.
Okay, and are there people who score 16, for example, and like we said, you might think that someone's doing something out to get you, but it doesn't really particularly bother you that much, and so you ignore it. Are there people who are just not paranoid enough or go right to the other end of the scale?
Well, it's interesting.
Does that even exist?
It's interesting. No, we don't really haven't looked at scientifically at the other ends and people who are perhaps overly trusting. They might perhaps be naive. And certainly it's in some professions, you wouldn't want it. If you work in politics, for example, you probably want to be able to be wary of other people's intentions. On the other hand, in certain environments, I suspect being trusting, you do very well, probably.
Time and tide wait for no man. Daniel, thank you so much for all of that stuff. Thanks to Nell and Ian for swanning in here, and sorry to drag you away from your emails and your other paranoid thoughts. Thanks also to Daniel Freeman. I'm Alok Jha. Thanks for allowing me to take up 59 million quartz vibrations of your time. Blame Andy Duckworth. He produced all this, and he's apparently very paranoid.
I'm pathologically thick-skinned. We already worked that out.
Or naive, I think.
Or naive.
Psychiatric term. It's people shouting at you, and you're like, oh, you're lovely. All of you.